Okay, so welcome back, everyone. And welcome to the first of the geochemistry lectures. So in this next hour and a half, I wanted to go through how we built or how we determine the bulk composition of the Earth and what we know about the early history of the Earth. And so there are sort of three topics that I wanted to cover. One was estimating Earth's composition. Then using extinct radionuclides to talk about the early differentiation of the Earth and the fact that some of these early formed heterogeneities are still preserved in the present day mantle. And then the third part was about the early atmosphere, just briefly touching upon, you know, when did we get the volatiles into Earth, where did they come from, and how did they get into the Earth's mantle. And as you probably realize, each one of these topics can probably we can probably spend a week on each one of these topics. So I will not cover maybe all of the details as we go through these topics, but I'll try and highlight some of the key debates that are still ongoing. Okay, so let's start off with this classification of elements. And one of the things you notice is that there are two classifications, one given for a nebular environment and the other given for a planetary environment. And the reason why we have these two different classifications is the first one, this classification of elements into refractory, volatile, and so on, allows us to figure out what the composition of the building blocks might be. And then the next set of classification in terms of lithophile, siderophile, meaning silicate-loving, iron-loving, and so on, tells us how these elements distribute themselves on a planet or on a planetesimal. And so that's why both of these classifications are important, because they're telling us about different parts of the process of building a planet. So when we're looking at the nebular environment, we have refractory components. These are elements that condense out of a solar gas at very high temperatures, typically above 1400 degrees. And here are some examples. I obviously don't expect you to kind of memorize all of these. So things like calcium, aluminum, titanium, rare earth elements, these are elements that come out of the solar gas as you start condensing this gas at high temperatures. Then we have a range of temperatures between, say, 1350 and 1250, where most of the magnesium, iron, and silicon come out. And then as temperatures drop, you get into the moderately volatile element. So something like potassium and lead we consider to be moderately volatile. And then ultimately, even lower, we have things like hydrogen, carbon, halogens, noble gases, and so on. When we talk about the planetary environments, we are talking about now how these elements distribute themselves into the silicate liquid, which would be a lithophile element. If it partitions into iron liquid, it would be siderophile, sulfur liquid, chalcophile. If it wants to be in the gas phase, that would be atmophile. So again, things like magnesium, calcium, aluminum would be lithophile. Siderophile would be things like iron, osmium, cobalt, and so on. Amphiphile are basically nitrogen, hydrogen, noble gases, and so on. Okay. And then again, a very quick note on the different building blocks. So when we are looking at meteorites, we are basically partitioning them into a set of differentiated meteorites, which are iron, stony irons, and achondrites. So irons are thought to be the cores of planetesimals. These achondrites are thought to be the crusts of differentiated planetesimals. The stony irons basically are a mixture of silicate and iron. And maybe a decade ago or so, we used to think that these are samples of the core mantle boundary. We no longer think that. It's quite possible that these stony irons are basically reflecting some kind of an impact process that have juxtaposed metal and silicate next to each other. In the undifferentiated meteorites, so these are our primitive meteorites, we call these guys chondrites, and the major reasons for calling them chondrites is because they have tiny little droplets of what were called, or what were melts previously, are chondrules, although it turns out that not all chondrites have chondrules. Amongst the chondrites, we break them up into carbonaceous chondrites. You can think of these as being basically rich in carbon or organic matter. The ordinary chondrites, these are ordinary because they make up like 80% of all of the discovered meteorites. That's why they're ordinary. And then the enster-type chondrites are basically chondrites which have the composition of the mineral pyroxene enster-type. Okay. So now this is looking at sort of the full suite of elements in the periodic table, and this is looking at the condensation temperatures, or the 50% condensation temperature of the different elements. And the way to read the 50% condensation temperature is that as temperatures maybe drops to something like 1700, maybe half of the hafnium would condense out of the gas phase. And what is highlighted here are some of these refractory elements, the main group elements, then the volatile elements. And now notice that, and as you get more and more into depth, you can't just have it be refractory, main group, and volatile. You have to kind of break it into highly refractory, moderately refractory, and so on. Zach.
Why is it only half of the elements? I mean, when I think about water, for example, going from 1 degree to minus one, all of it freezes.
So this is just based on basic thermodynamic calculations. And that's how it's always been kind of defined, that it's the temperature at which half of the elements are coming out. If somebody wants to say or make a comment on that.
But there's chemistry involved here too, right? It's not that thorium is coming out as a thorium element. It's coming out reacted with something. And so there are many chemical reactions that can draw these elements out.
That is exactly right. And these are also based on equilibrium calculations, meaning that they don't take into account any kind of reactions that might happen between the condensed gray and the remaining dust. One way of thinking about this is if you look at, for example, sodium and silicon should never be associated with each other because silicon is coming out of the gas phase at much higher temperatures. So you would almost predict there would never be a sodium feldspar, but in reality you do find sodium feldspar, and that's basically an indication that the silicate dust that's coming out then ends up reacting with the residual gas to then make other phases. So these equilibrium calculations, I would say, are a good starting guide to give us intuition in terms of how elements would be coming out of the gas phase into the dust grains, and how some of these elements might be distributed in the solar nebula. We should not be taking these equilibrium condensation calculations to directly predict what the planetesimal compositions would be as a function of heliocentric distance. Okay, but I wanted to point out one aspect of this particular figure, which is when you look at these refractory elements, you would notice that there is a suite of elements about right about there, which all appear to come out of this gas phase at roughly the same temperatures. And I'll come back to this, and this has led to this concept that it is very hard to fractionate these elements from each other as you cool the solar nebula to condensed dust grains, meaning that different regions of the solar nebula are very likely to have similar ratios of these refractory elements because they're all coming out over a very narrow temperature range. On the other hand, you could imagine if you're looking at something like, well, let's say thorium to the ratio of iron on silicon, because this is such an extended temperature range, you might expect different regions of the nebula to have very different ratios of uranium to silicon, or say magnesium to sodium, and so on. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, Lars.
Oh, thank you. So the similarity of those elements ending with thorium, I guess I have two questions. So to what extent does that reflect some uncertainties in the thermodynamic calculations, lack of basic data about what some of these oddball elements might do and what compounds they might
That's
form?
Right.
And the other question I had is, what is the horizontal axis?
So the horizontal axis is, so that's a great question. Both are great questions. Let me answer the second one first. So this is basically the temperature, and the horizontal axis is a classic Celtic plot. So this is basically the elements. Okay. So Yeah. No, it's not an atomic number. It's just these elements. Okay. Yeah. So organized by the temperature at which they're condensing out. So the higher temperature elements are on the left-hand side. The elements that condense out at lower temperatures on the right, on the right-hand side. Yeah. So this is just, you can think of this as the periodic table, or the elements in the periodic table. Your first question is also extremely valid. Yes, some of these, the thermodynamic parameters for some of these compounds are not known, and often from time to time you will actually notice these elements jump around quite a bit. So yeah, those are certainly caveats to keep in mind. Yes?
Just wondering, condensation temperature means the gas phase condenses to solid.
That's right. So in this case, the gas phase is not going to condense into a liquid because the pressures are very low. So these condensation calculations are typically done or are reflective of pressures on the order of 10 to the minus 4 bars of hydrogen. Okay.
To what Bruce was referring to, but condensation from a particular phase, let's say for instance water, because water was brought in, if it is just H2O gas to H2O liquid or solid, will that be the same as, let's say, H2O hosted in a mineral? Will that temperature, how do you then define condensation temperature?
So that is basically determining where these elements are plotting. So for example, if hydrogen is only going to come out as H2O ice, that's going to be at a much lower temperature than if it is going to be associated with, say, serpentine, because, yeah.
Okay.
So that is taken into account in terms of making these. Now, some of the things to remember is that it is, kinetically, it's challenging to make serpentine in the nebula. Just because the reaction rates are going to be very slow.
There is an article by Sisla on shockwave.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, but that's not a equilibrium condensation calculation. Yeah. Okay. So if we take again this very simple view of condensation, and if we think about what a simple view of the temperatures in the nebula might have been early on, with high temperatures. So this is temperature against distance. So high temperatures near the sun, lower temperatures further out, you would basically predict that things that are forming close to Mercury and Venus would basically be these metal oxides. As you get further out, you will start having iron nickel, silicate grains, feldspars, iron sulfides, and then around the, maybe between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter, you might start condensing out things like water ice. And again, because most of the mass of the nebula is contained in hydrogen, most of this condensation up here is going to be dominated by these ices, water ice, ammonia ice, methane ice, and so on. So just to kind of recap this, you know, again, this very simple view of planet formation is you're starting off with a hot interior, and in the inner regions, so this is the frost line demarcating regions that separate where you have condensation of water ice versus areas that do not have water ice. So up here, you're basically condensing silicate minerals and metals. You're not condensing water. Up here, you're condensing silicates and metals, but you're also condensing all of those hydrogen compounds, the nitrogen-bearing compounds, and the carbonaceous compounds. Okay, so that would mean that, again, around Mercury's orbit, you will have primary refractory oxides and metal. And then as you move outward to Venus and Earth, you will start building up these silicate material. Okay. And then finally, behind the frost line, which is between the present-day orbits of Mars and Jupiter, you will start condensing ices. So that's basically the zeroth order view of planet formation and how the chemistry might vary. In reality, things are going to be much more complicated. And part of that is related to a very simple fact that the temperatures in the disks are not going to be static. the disk temperatures are actually going to be a function of the accretion rate of the gas onto the star. So this is a figure from Wood 2000. So this is showing you again the radial distance against the mid-plane temperatures parameterized by different accretion rates onto the central star. So accretion rates of 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, so m dot, that's indicating a solar mass. So this is typical of a T Tauri stage. And overall, the way to think about this is that as time progresses, the accretion rate onto the star will decrease. But overall, it turns out that while there's going to be a decrease, it's actually going to oscillate back and forth, meaning initially you might start off with these high accretion rates, it might drop down to 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8, but then accretion rates can go back up and it can then go back down again. And so if you think about that scenario, you can now explore, if you're standing at, say, 1 AU, what kind of a temperature history would you experience as these accretion rates sort of drop and then come back up and drop again? And one of the things you notice is, so this is the mid-plane temperature, this is at 1 AU, so you can notice that initially your temperatures at 1 AU where Earth is would be maybe around 2000. And at some point it drops down to 1200, but then notice it actually drops all the way down to close to 300 Kelvin, very, very close to where you will start condensing water ice. So right off the bat, you should remember that this frost line that I just showed you is not a static line. It's basically moving in, and then it can move back out as these accretion rates again increase. And so if you're standing again on Earth, the composition that you might be making by condensing the solar gas, that dust grain at some point might no longer be stable and can basically flash back into the gas phase again. So that is one complication that we actually have to keep in mind in terms of figuring out how the chemistry is going to be changing in the disk. And basically the take-home point would be it's going to be a time-variant parameter. The second thing to consider is that there's actually going to be a lot of material flow back and forth, which means that the feeding zones of the planets and the embryos are actually going to be large. And so I'm hoping this is going to work. So this is a simulation from Raymond and Isidoro in 2017 that shows scattering of planetesimals inward by the growth of Jupiter and Saturn. And so this is not looking at Grand Tech. And so that's Jupiter and Saturn, and these are water-rich embryos or planetesimals, and you notice that as these planets grow, they're getting scattered back and scattered out. And this is the present-day asteroid belt. And this is happening very early on. So what this is kind of indicating is that as these, so Earth and Venus are up there, as we are growing the terrestrial planets, they're actually getting bombarded by material or by these more volatile rich material near Jupiter and Saturn. And so this is a simulation that's basically showing this transport of material inwards. There are also simulations that shows that you will have ejection of planetesimals from where Earth and Venus is into the outer solar system. So there's basically going to be exchange of material between the inner and the outer solar system. So again, this very simple static picture that I've indicated, that you take the condensation sequence, predict what composition comes out, you have a temperature profile, you can make a prediction of the composition of the planets, it's not really valid. You really have to treat this as a dynamic problem. And so one of the take-home points would be that because of how the temperature is going to be time variant, and how material is going to move back and forth, it is going to be highly unlikely that you will find an object in the solar system with the exact same composition as the Earth. You might find analogs, but probably not something that would be exactly the same. Okay, so just a quick isotope terminology in terms of what I mean by when I say some of these terms. So there are three terms here: radioactive isotope, radiogenic isotope, and a non-radiogenic isotope. So if I say it's a radioactive isotope, you should think about that this isotope will undergo radioactive decay. if it's a radiogenic isotope, it means it is the isotope that is being produced or that was produced by radioactive decay. A non-radiogenic isotope is basically a stable isotope that has not been affected by decay. Okay, and so if you see variations in these non-radiogenic isotopes, those are normally reflected, or those are normally reflective of nucleosynthetic anomalies, meaning that the solar system basically got grains from different stellar sources, and those grains were never completely homogenized. Okay, so this is a figure that is showing you the isotopes of chromium against the isotopes of titanium, and these are, again, these non-radiogenic isotopes, so they're only in this case being affected by nucleosynthetic anomalies. And the symbol epsilon is an indication that we are looking at deviations from a standard in parts per 10,000. So these are pretty small differences. So when you look at this plot of chromium isotopes against titanium isotopes, one of the things you notice is that these carbonaceous chondrite plot way out there, different from all of the rest of the field. This is where the ordinary chondrites plot. This is the enstatite chondrites, and the Earth is here. So right off the bat, you would notice that the Earth does not look in terms of its isotopic DNA, does not look like the ordinary chondrites, definitely does not look like the carbonaceous chondrites. And the closest analog is these enstatite chondrites. But the enstatite chondrites overlap with the Earth's field, but they are not identical, and their averages are distinct from the terrestrial compositions. So this is just kind of reiterating the point that there is not likely to be any single body that would tell us about what the composition of the Earth is like. And so people have now played these games with many different kinds of isotopes, in addition to titanium and chromium, oxygen isotopes, molybdenum isotopes, ruthenium isotopes. All of these, again, are non-radiogenic isotopes that indicate that the Earth looks closest to these enstatite chondrites, but are not identical to the enstatite chondrites, and they're very different from the carbonaceous and ordinary chondrites. Okay, so if Earth doesn't have an exact match in the solar system...
Can we get the microphone, or I just...
No.
So let's
just go back to the enstatite chondrites for a second. They look a lot like the Earth. So can you tell us, besides, you know, the average composition, why we cannot say that the Earth is this gigantic enstatite chondrite?
So in terms of the bulk composition, they have a little too much silicon. So if you have, if you build up the planet with something that looks exactly like enstatite chondrites, you have to put a lot of silicon into the core. And some of the recent estimates from Badru indicates that with that amount of silicon, it is very hard to match the bulk sound speeds in the core. Dominique had a question back there.
So, Joy, do these differences match the distance?
I was not going to go there, but yes, this is a very interesting question. One of the points here is that there is this gap between where these carbonaceous chondrites plot and where these ordinary and enstatite chondrites plot. And so one interpretation is that this is looking at a suite of planetesimals that might have formed exterior to Jupiter, and these might be planetesimals that formed interior to Jupiter. And the reason why maybe you have nothing here is because that stuff has been cleared out. That is kind of a working hypothesis. But it needs to be tested dynamically.
So when you say Earth and Moon and Mars, is that for bulk silicate Earth?
That's the bulk silicate Earth, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Laurent?
Yeah, so how well do we really know this, the crust, and how big the crust should be within uncertainty? I mean, bulk silicate itself is a model.
That's right.
Where you have to decide on some assumptions. So, I don't know. How much confidence do I have to put? I mean, the Earth and Moon are the same or not, depending on how much I want to count the size of those crosses. So what do I do?
So I'll get into that in terms of how we estimate the bulk composition. It looks like the Earth and the Moon are, within errors, the same in, again, a whole suite of isotopes. Maybe there is, you know, 2 ppm, 4 ppm differences in the oxygen isotopes. But yeah. Okay, so what this means is if there is no single body that we can put our hand on and say, this is what the Earth looks like, we basically have to make some ground rules in terms of estimating the composition of the Earth. And so here is a set of ground rules which basically states that we're going to use mantle prototypes with some knowledge of melt extraction, and then assume that Earth has certain refractory element ratios that are in the same proportion as in carbonaceous chondrites. So in this case, we are not assuming that the Earth, even though this is called the chondritic Earth model, we are not actually assuming that the Earth is a photocopy of the chondrites. We are assuming that Earth and carbonaceous chondrites share some highly refractory element ratios that are identical. Okay. Because if you assume basically that the elements are present in the same proportions as carbonaceous chondrites, obviously we're not going to get the right answer. Okay, and then we'll talk about challenges to these ideas that have been made. Okay, so why is it kind of reasonable to make this assumption that Earth and chondrites have the same refractory element ratios? So on the x-axis here, you're looking at a suite of carbonaceous chondrite, Earth, and then ordinary chondrites. And on the y-axis, you're looking at the normalized abundances of these elements, normalized to titanium, and then further normalized to that ratio in CI chondrites. So for example, this is basically the aluminum-titanium ratio in CM chondrites divided by the aluminum-titanium ratios in CI chondrites. So one of the things to remember is that aluminum and calcium are refractory elements. So what you notice is that across these suite of different meteorites, even into the ordinary chondrites, the calcium-titanium ratio and the aluminum-titanium ratio doesn't really vary a whole lot. It's pretty constant. If you want to argue that there are 5% variations, I will absolutely give that to you. But you can basically figure out that this is not a variation that's at the level of 10%. It's much smaller than that. And if you start looking at some of the elements that are in the main group or in the volatile group, such as zinc in the volatile group, amongst these different meteorites, there are enormous variations, right? So the titanium-zinc ratio in CI chondrites is very different from the titanium-zinc ratio in ordinary chondrites. So again, for these elements, then you cannot assume that they are present in refractory proportions. But this is the key reason, because you don't see a big variation in this refractory element ratios in the different meteorite classes, you can make that assumption. So it's not kind of just pulling it out of thin air. Okay, so the next exercise would be to take measurements of different major elements in mantle prototypes and plot them against these refractory element ratios. And so this is a figure from McDonough and Son where samarium-ytterbium ratios, calcium-ytterbium ratios, these are all highly refractory element ratios, are plotted against the titanium concentrations. And then you would regress these to intersect this ratio at at the CI chondrite value and read off the appropriate titanium concentration of the bulk silicate Earth. Okay. So that's how we would establish, for example, the major element composition of, let's say, titanium. And then the next part of the game is to basically regress these elements against each other. And you often will see very good correlations. This is, I unfortunately could not find a relationship or a figure that showed a simple relationship between titanium and magnesium. But if you look at, for example, magnesium versus calcium versus aluminum and silicon, you see very nice correlations. Right? And so what this means is that you kind of daisy chain your estimates where first you determine titanium, then you would regress titanium to magnesium, determine magnesium, regress that against these elements, and then just read off based on the magnesium content of the bulk silicate earth, what the calcium, aluminum, silicon, and so on are. And so this is basically the essence of this chondritic earth model, where you are using the measured chemistry in mantle-derived rocks and the fact that the element ratios of certain refractory elements are the same to basically build up the periodic table for the Earth. Laurent.
So going back again on the uncertainty, mantle peridotite, that's an upper mantle phase.
That's right, yes.
Melting is at very shallow conditions. What tells us that those same correlations would hold if you had the same abundance of rock coming from the lowermost mantle?
So isotopically and based on mass balances, it's believed that what you see in the morp source is representative of a very large fraction of the mantle. It is whether that mantle is 70% or 95%, you can argue. But it is certainly reflective of the majority of the mantle. Whether the lowermost mantle is different in its major element composition is certainly a very valid question. So for example, if we look at the LLSVPs, it is probably clear that the LLSVPs are not the same as the rest of the mantle. And that feature is not taken into account in terms of coming up with the bulk composition of the Earth. What I will say is that I think in terms of the major element chemistry, the uncertainties are probably not horrendous. But if we start looking at the abundances of the trace elements and the minor elements, then I would argue that there you have much bigger uncertainties. And some of these trace elements and minor elements are what we use for looking at things like isotopic mass balance. And so there the uncertainties are probably bigger.
So if you're using the mantle like silica and that sort of thing with major is like continental material, do you take that into account as well?
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
So do you take into account that like most of the silica is in the continental crust and then, or yeah, how do you deal with those sort of reservoirs?
I think most of the silicon is actually still in the mantle. So silicon is one of these elements that has a partition coefficient pretty close to one, meaning it'll divide itself equally between a melt and a residue. And because the continental crust is 0.2% of the Earth's mass, most of the silicon is going to be in the mantle. Okay. So there are other ways of estimating the bulk composition, at least for these major elements like magnesium, calcium, and iron. And this is an example from Pamian and O'Neill, where they're plotting the iron content of the mantle peridotites against the magnesium contents. And so as you basically melt the mantle, you enrich the mantle in magnesium. So basically you should think of this as the higher you go in this, or the further you go in this direction, the more melt extraction the mantle has seen. And the argument up here was that if you look at these peridotites from four different localities, for a range of magnesium contents, the iron contents, or the average iron contents, are basically the same, about 8.1%. And again, that is not a huge surprise because the partition coefficient of iron is also something that's very close to one. So even though these have seen some degree of melt extraction, you're not seeing a big variation in the iron content. And so in this case, the argument was you can use these observations to fix the FeO content of the mantle to about 8.1%, use the knowledge of the magnesium number, which is basically the molar magnesium to magnesium plus iron ratio, to get at the magnesium content of the mantle. And then you would do the same game where you would regress magnesium against silicon, against calcium, against titanium, and so on. And in that case, again, you are not basing your estimates on anything that's related to carbonaceous chondrites or to the refractory elements for estimating the composition of the major elements. And when you do this, you get numbers that are not identical to what you have in McDonough and Son, but something that is fairly close. Usually the differences are on the order of a few percent. I think I saw a question there.
So kind of following Laurent's question, I look at this plot and I notice, for example, for Zarbagad, the y-axis is 8.6%. And then I look at the FeO content of the mantle and it's 8.1 plus or minus 0.05. And so I just wonder how some of these uncertainties are actually, like, are they as robust as they should be, perhaps?
So I will tell you what this is. This is basically the standard error of the mean. And you can argue whether that's a reasonable error to take.
Okay.
I think it's a very valid question whether you should take the standard deviation of these different values or whether you should take the standard error. This is likely underrepresenting the errors. I agree. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so when you do that, this is a figure from the treatise on geophysics by Halliday and Wood, and it's based on the bulk compositions from McDonough and Son. And so what you see, again, are these refractory lithophile elements that have the same proportions as carbonaceous chondrites. And then as you get into the more volatile elements, you start seeing a depletion, and this is known as the volatility trend. And there are certain elements that you would notice deviates substantially from this volatility trend, and these plot down here. So some of these are chalcophile elements, some of these are siderophile elements. So the potential argument is that these elements are depleted in the silicate earth because they've been drawn down into the core during core formation. And overall, this trend or this depletion in volatile elements, we do not think reflects a loss of these elements from the earth. It simply reflects the fact that the Earth never got these elements as it grew. Okay.
Chalcophile elements go?
So the chalcophile elements are sulfur-loving, which would basically mean that if there's sulfur that's also going into the core, that's where they would all end up as well. Yeah. Okay, so again, just a quick reminder about, because I'm going to now talk a little bit about the non-chondritic Earth and what that was based on. So again, a quick reminder of this radioactive isotope. That means it's undergoing radioactive decay. The radiogenic is the daughter product from the isotope decay, and then the non-radiogenic isotope is not affected by any kind of radioactive decay. Okay, so this challenge to using the same refractory element ratios to estimating the Earth's composition came in about 2005 from a paper by Boy and Carlson. And so what you're looking here is on the x-axis is the neodymium isotope composition. So I should probably back up a little bit. So neodymium-142 comes from the decay of samarium-146. And samarium-146 is a extinct radionuclide. So it had a half-life of about 100 million years. A good rule of thumb is after 6 half-lives, the isotope is extinct, which means basically after 600 million years, the isotope is gone. And again, epsilon is basically this ratio of this. So this is the radioactive isotope. This is the radiogenic isotope, 142. And then 144 is the non-radiogenic isotope. Okay, and so epsilon is basically this 142, 144 in a sample normalized to the standard. And you're looking at deviations from the standard in parts per 10,000. And there's a new notation because instruments are much more powerful these days. And so you will see a little bit later the notation of mu. And mu simply reflects, instead of a deviation in parts per 10,000, it would be a deviation in parts per million. Okay, so 10 to the 6. Okay, so what you're observing here on the bottom panel, so these are a suite of chondrites. These are differentiated meteorites, the eucrites, and then this is the Earth's mantle. And so by default, the Earth's mantle is zero. And relative to the Earth's mantle, these meteorites, The carbonaceous chondrites are shifted a little bit further off. The ordinary chondrites are about here. And when this paper first came out, there wasn't really a great suite of measurements for the instatite chondrites. But what this set of observations indicated was that this isotope ratio, this 142-144 ratio, in the meteorites and in bulk silicate earth was very different. So how do you want to think about it? So one way of thinking about it is if you have the same initial starting point for bulk silicate earth and for the meteorites, so they're both starting off at the same 142-144, then the fact that earth is to the right simply indicates it has more of this decay product relative to meteorites. And I should point out that this is the accessible part of the silicate earth. So the fact that it has more of this decay product can be interpreted in a couple different ways. One way of interpreting it is to say that earth suffered an early differentiation that enriched the silicate earth in 146 samarium, which then ended up producing this excess 142. And then there's a hidden reservoir somewhere. That hidden reservoir could either be somewhere in the deep mantle, or it could be hidden in space. And I'll talk about maybe what that phrase hidden in space might be. And that reservoir would be somewhere out here, so that when you add this hidden reservoir with the accessible silicate earth reservoir, you would go back to this meteorite composition. The other way of interpreting would be the reason you have this excess 142 is you're starting at the same isotopic composition, but the Earth had a higher ratio of samarium to neodymium. And because it had a higher ratio of samarium to neodymium relative to the chondrites, you ended up with more of this decay product of 142, and that's why the silicate Earth is to the right. And so this is this fundamental challenge to the concept of Earth and the carbonaceous chondrites sharing the same refractory lithophile elements, because both samarium and neodymium are lithophile, silicate-loving, and they're refractory elements. And so this would be a clear indication that the Earth and the chondrites do not have the same refractory lithophile element. And so there's been this vigorous debate about if you take away that ground rule, how do you actually establish the composition of the minor and the trace element ratios? This higher samarium to neodymium ratio turns out to be on the order of 6 to maybe 7% higher than chondrites, so not a huge amount, and it has virtually very little effect on the composition of magnesium, calcium, silicon, and so on. But it really has a profound effect on things like the heat-producing elements. So something like the potassium content of the Earth could drop by about 50%. The uranium and thorium contents likewise could drop by 50%. So these have, even though this is only 6%, it has a powerful influence on the heat budget of the Earth. So I'm now going to talk about the fact, what if this is not necessarily correct? The fact that the meteorites and the Earth start off with the same isotopic composition. And there's some recent work that has been done which indicates that maybe that's not the right way to think about it, meaning that Earth and meteorites did not start off at the same point. So this non-chondritic Earth model with the higher samarium neodymium or this hidden reservoir assumes that the isotopic composition of the Earth and the chondrites are the same. And that, again, has been challenged. And so the take-home point is, what if they're different? And so here is one way of thinking about this. So what if these different objects did not have the same starting 142 neodymium, 144 neodymium? In which case, you would have to think about what that difference between Earth and the meteorites really mean. So is it possible? So these isotopes of one of neodymium, both 142 and 144, are made by different stellar processes. One is a slow neutron capture process in star, and the other is a rapid neutron capture process that's typically associated with supernovas. And so what if the solar system had a inhomogeneous mixture of these R and S process nucleosynthetic material? And what if these different meteorites had sampled different regions of the solar system? And as I'd indicated in the, or as the simulations in Raymond and Isidore indicated, you're having a lot of material exchange between the inner and the outer solar system. And so there's no reason to believe that any given object samples material from only one single locality. So again, if we assume that the solar nebula was heterogeneous in the distribution of R and S process nuclides, then maybe the Earth had a different starting composition than the meteorites. And to really test this, what you would have to do is you would have to investigate isotopes that are not affected by radioactive decay, which means you want to look at systems that have a variation associated with nucleosynthetic anomalies, but not necessarily with radioactive decay. And so here is a recent study from Burkhardt in 2016, and there have been follow-up studies by a different group, Bouvier and Boyer, and then again Boyer et al. In 2018. And so here, notice now that we have gone from this epsilon notation now to a mu notation. So again, just a reminder, mu is deviation in parts per 10 to the 6. So these isotopes of 145 neodymium and 148 neodymium are not affected by radioactive decay. So these are only reflecting nucleosynthetic anomalies, and these are telling us about mixing of the different stellar components. And so again, by default, the Earth is at the center point, 0, 0. And the enstatite chondrites are sort of closest to this point, 0, 0. The ordinary chondrites are a little bit off. And then this is Allende, which is a carbonaceous chondrite that plots further up. And then this is a differentiated achondrite. So what this is suggesting is that the different meteorite parent bodies do not have the same initial starting neodymium isotope composition. So if they have different 145 to 144 ratios, if they have different 148 to 144 ratios, then most likely they will also have a different 142 to 144 ratio, which means you cannot make the assumption that the Earth and the meteorites are starting at the same point. If you look at this correlation now, so this is this neodymium 142 on the top panel, neodymium 148 on the bottom panel, plotted against molybdenum isotopes. So these molybdenum is a siderophile element. It is not highly siderophile, which means that a large fraction of this is actually in the mantle. And again, these isotopes are not affected by radioactive decay. And in this case, you're looking at a relate correlation between non-radiogenic isotopes with this radiogenic 142. And this is looking at correlations between non-radiogenic neodymium and non-radiogenic molybdenum. And basically what you're looking at, so this is the Earth, this is enstatite chondrites, this is ordinary chondrites. They're plotting on a mixing line with Earth not looking like any of the meteorites in neodymium or molybdenum isotopes. And especially for molybdenum isotopes, you can notice that there's a fairly big shift between Earth and enstatite chondrites and between Earth and ordinary chondrites. So again, what you have to do is you have to step back and figure out what you do with this piece of information, meaning what does this mean for interpreting your epsilon 142, and therefore what does it mean for interpreting the bulk composition of the Earth. What I will say is that these observations have just ticked the needle back towards this chondritic Earth model again in terms of using the highly refractory element ratios and saying that they are the same between carbonaceous chondrites and between Earth. You had a question there.
So here the notation is mu, right?
That's right.
10 to 6. But for the neodymium 142 is epsilon. Epsilon is 10 to 4.
That's right.
Right? So the order is 2, like 10 to 2 order larger than the neodymium 142. So how much difference can this make on the difference for the epsilon 142?
So if we go back. So this is, notice that this is in units of 0.2. So basically, if you take the average up here, which is the average for the carbonaceous chondrites, average for ordinary chondrites, Earth and ordinary chondrites differ by 0.2 epsilon, which is the same as 20 parts per million or 20. In this scale, it would be 0 to 20. Okay.
Would you mean 0 to 200?
No, 20, because it's 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, it's me again. I'm surprised that this is surprising, because because I must be missing something. Earlier, you had this diagram which had, I forget which exact elements were having an epsilon this time. There was like the chondrite on the right making a band. There was actually, that's where I asked you my first question. These were isotope ratios. They show heterogeneity between various types of chondrites versus objects in a solar system. So can we just from that evidence say that, you know, those isotopes are not the same for every body in the solar system?
Yes.
Okay.
But it is always nice. It is always nice if you can actually demonstrate it for the system of interest, right? Right, because then you have really learned something. Yeah. Yes, Dominique.
Well, I just would like to emphasize 2 points. The first is that all the Earth models were made on the basis that Earth was chondritic, and so that disturbed everybody. And people have seen that with the stable light isotopes for many, many years, and so they don't find it surprising. But for these heavier elements, that's those guys, the neodymium, are the ones that were on the horizontal line in the very beginning versus condensation. So people did not expect any variation. And here we're talking about variation in the same elements. Mm-hmm. The second thing, it might be a detail, but I think it's very important. Any single one of these measurements takes 24 hours on the mass spec. And it's the limit of what we can do analytically. And those are very, very big challenge, especially finding the right samples to analyze. Just as a side story, or put things in a context.
Yeah. So thank you, Dominique, for that. And just to kind of reiterate that, there's a reason why, and a lot of us are interested in, where would Mars plot on this figure? And there's a reason why Mars is not on this figure, which is we do not have enough material to make something like a molybdenum isotope measurement on SNC meteorites. Sure, yes. That was, yeah. Hopefully. Yeah.
Does R process versus S process, does that perturb any elemental ratios like samarium, neodymium, or others?
No. So the reason, so it's, if we look at these are differences in the parts per million, right? And our ability to measure elemental ratios are, at best, maybe per mil. So if there are variations that are being introduced here for the elements, they're going to be undetectable. Yeah. Okay, so I think the last word on the Earth's composition has certainly not been said. So just the fact that the Earth has a different starting point from carbonaceous chondrite does not necessarily have to mean that the Earth will also have the same refractory element ratios as CI chondrites. They could actually exist in the same world, meaning that the Earth is starting off a different point and the Earth and the meteorites not having the same refractory element ratios. So there is a fair bit of work that is still being done in terms of understanding planet formation in terms of what happens to differentiated planetesimals as you collide them? Do you actually accrete the entire planetesimals, or during the accretion of these planetesimals to embryos, do you lose some of their differentiated crust? And if you lose some of their differentiated crust, which is known as this collisional erosion process, then that would be a way where, even though the Earth is starting off at a different initial neodymium isotopic composition, the samarium-neodymium ratio do not have to be conserved. They could end up being different because you're eroding part of the crust. And so that has not yet fully played out. I think there's still work being done in terms of figuring out whether collisional erosion on planetesimals is an important process. An initial way of talking about this hidden reservoir for the Earth, and I'd refer to this as being hidden in space, was the idea that something like the moon forming impact might have blown off the crust or blown off a chunk of the crust. And we now know that that's not really physically possible. You cannot lose the Earth's crust in a giant impact. Turns out it's really hard to even lose something like an ocean in a giant impact. So certainly the crust is not going to be lost. So if you want to lose crust, you have to do this during the planetesimal stage and not at the embryo stage or at the planet stage. Yes?
I was just wondering if we have any recovered samples of lost crust from any other bodies, you know, any meteorites that are concentrated in just vaporized material that would suggest you can remove it from a system.
So Sarah's shaking her head. So first, the achondrites are basically the crusts of differentiated planetesimals, right? So they're certainly being stripped off. And the interesting aspect is if you look at these planetesimals, there's a lot of samples of iron cores. There's a lot of samples of the crust. There are almost no samples of the mantle. Right? Where did the mantle go? So you certainly are getting just the crust stripped off from these different shaded planetesimals. Okay, so lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about a suite of elements down here. These are called these highly siderophile elements, and these partition into the core very, very strongly. And so this has been known for a long time that these elements have very different affinities for the core. Even though they're highly siderophile, these crosses are showing you what their abundances in the mantle would be based on metal silicate partitioning experiments done at low pressures. At higher pressures, the story changes a little bit, but not that much. So if this set of elements were affected by low pressure partitioning experiments, then their abundance in the mantle should be mimicking these crosses, and they're clearly not. What you see for these suite of elements is that their abundances are in the same proportion as CI chondrites, and that's because the element abundances here have been normalized to carbonaceous chondrites. Okay? So if something looks flat, or if a suite of elements looks flat, in this case, it means that they have the same proportions as in CI chondrites. And the other interesting aspect is that you would predict that these would be 4 to 5 orders of magnitude depleted, but they're only depleted by about a factor of 100. And so the concept here was that after the formation of the moon, which is when core formation ends, you brought in these elements associated with the late veneer. And for the longest time, we used to think that this late veneer was volatile rich, and it also brought in things like carbon and hydrogen and nitrogen to the planet. So here is a recent paper from Fischer Gaudi et al., and they're looking at the isotopic composition of ruthenium. So ruthenium is one of these highly siderophile elements that goes strongly into the core, and so this element in the mantle is all being brought in after the last giant impact or after the moon-forming giant impact. And again, there is no kind of radioactive decay associated with it, so this is all looking at nucleosynthetic anomalies. So the Earth's composition is basically on this black line, and what you're seeing on the bottom panel are iron meteorites, enstatite chondrites, ordinary chondrites, carbonaceous chondrites. And right off the bat, you could say that what brought in ruthenium to the Earth doesn't look like carbonaceous chondrites, because these carbonaceous chondrites are well off to the left-hand side. It doesn't look like even ordinary chondrites, because that's also pretty far off. The closest analog ends up being, again, these enstatite chondrites, but again, they're not the same. They overlap, but the average is shifted away from the Earth's composition. So again, an indication that there is stuff that's probably out to the right-hand side that we are not sampling here. That there is material that made up the Earth that is not sampled in the present-day collection of meteorites that we have. The other interesting aspect of this is if you think that most of the ruthenium is being brought in by objects that look very similar to enstatite chondrites, these are objects that are not particularly rich in things like carbon or nitrogen and water. And so therefore, these elements cannot be responsible for the these meteorites coming in after the moon-forming impact could not be responsible for bringing in most of the volatile elements on the Earth. Nicola Duffy, in a recent paper, used this correlation between ruthenium isotopes and molybdenum isotopes. So I showed you a molybdenum isotope figure a little while back. And he used these correlations to basically argue that the material that came in prior to the moon-forming impact looks exactly like the material that came in after the moon-forming impact, meaning there wasn't a big change in the feeding zone of Earth. Okay, so having spent most of the time on talking about the composition of the Earth, I wanted to now go into the second aspect, which was talking about extinct radionuclides and about the early history of the Earth. So this very top equation that relates the radiogenic daughter today, which is equal to some initial daughter product, plus the radioactive parent multiplied by e to the lambda t, where lambda is the decay constant and t is time. And then all of these ratios are normalized to a non-radiogenic stable isotope. So this is sort of the equation that a lot of people are familiar with. This is sort of the equation for long-lived systems like uranium-lead, rubidium-strontium, the long-lived 147 samarium to 143 neodymium. When we talk about extinct radionuclides, basically all of this parent has decayed away. There is no parent left. So the abundance of the daughter product is whatever you had at time zero plus the entire inventory of the parent. And there is no time information here. So does that mean we geochemists just make up stuff about how to get time? So the trick that we play is we find an isotope of this radioactive parent that is non-radiogenic and stable. And I'm going to call that isotope here P of S, and I multiplied this term by P and P of S and divided by P of S. Okay. So that's just a very simple game I'm going to play. Okay, and so we are going to look at one example using the system hafnium tungsten, which is extremely powerful in terms of looking at core formation. So hafnium is lithophile, which means it'll remain in the silicate portion of the mantle. Tungsten is moderately siderophile, which means it'll enter the core. And then the half-life is about 9 million years. And so again, the rule of thumb is that roughly in 55 million years, this 182 hafnium is all extinct, meaning it has all been transformed into 182 tungsten. Okay. So I'm going to start off with this figure that shows a stable non-radiogenic isotope of hafnium. So remember, 182 is the radioactive isotope, and this is the stable non-radiogenic isotope of tungsten. And 182 tungsten is produced by the decay of this element, and this is also divided by this 184 tungsten. And I'm going to look at three reservoirs, one with a low hafnium tungsten ratio, one with an intermediate hafnium tungsten ratio, and one with a high hafnium tungsten ratio. And I'm going to assume that they're all, and because isotopes in general are not going to fractionate, I'm going to state that they're all going to start with the same tungsten isotopic composition, but they'll have different ratios of 180 hafnium to 184 hafnium. So again, this is the stable non-radiogenic isotope of the extinct nuclide, and then this is the stable radiogenic daughter of the extinct nuclide. And so this is going to be time, and if people have seen the long-lived system, you'll notice how different evolution in this particular space is going to be. So this is how the isotopes are going to evolve as a function of time. And now the system has gone extinct and nothing is happening. Okay. Oops. So this is basically called a fossil isochron. The other thing I hope you kind of notice, I can go back here. So if we start the clock, notice that the evolution moves these data points vertically up. So in a normal isochron for long-lived systems, they would actually move in this direction. And that's because in the normal isochron, we would plot the radioactive parent here. But in this case, none of these isotopes are radioactive. So this particular ratio in these reservoirs do not change. Once you set this hafnium-tungsten ratio in the different reservoir, this value doesn't change. The only thing that changes in this space is the isotopic composition of tungsten. And the reason why that's happening is because a reservoir that has more of 180 hafnium will also have more of this 182. Okay, and so if it has more of this radioactive 182, it'll produce more of the tungsten 182. And that data point will lie there. If it has low hafnium-tungsten ratios, it'll have a lower abundance of this. And so the generated isotopic compositions are not going to be as radioactive. And so in this case, this slope has meaning. It is not directly a time that comes out of the slope. What you get is the ratio of the radioactive parent to the non-radiogenic stable isotope at the time you made these three different reservoirs. And there's a reason why we're talking about this three reservoirs. You can imagine that if you that this intermediate hafnium-tungsten ratio reservoir is kind of your primitive chondritic meteorites, undifferentiated. And a high hafnium-tungsten reservoir would be the silicate mantle, because most of the hafnium is retained in the silicate and the tungsten has gone in the core. The low hafnium-tungsten reservoir would be equivalent to the core, where most of the tungsten goes in and very little hafnium goes in. So what this means is that if this is your undifferentiated body, then the silicate mantle evolves to more radiogenic ratios than the bulk, and the core, or the metal, would evolve to a lower radiogenic ratios than the core. And so if you're normalizing all of your measured values to this undifferentiated object, then basically the silicate would end up with a positive value, and the metal, because it's lower than the bulk, would end up with a negative value. Okay, so you should think about silicates being positive in tungsten and metal being negative in terms of its tungsten isotopic composition. Okay, so again, what that ratio tells us is, sorry, what that slope tells us is the ratio of this extinct nuclide to the stable non-radiogenic isotope of hafnium. And the slope of that line also tells us what this initial tungsten isotopic ratio is. And then as time progresses, basically the slope of this line becomes shallow and the intercept of this line keeps moving up. And the reason why the intercept moves up is because with time, more 182 tungsten is being produced. And so the way we extract time information from these extinct radionuclides is by basically looking at the slopes, which tells us at these two different times, T1 and T2, what the 182 hafnium to 180 hafnium ratio is. And then these two ratios are basically related to the decay constant of hafnium and the passage of time, or delta time, that has elapsed between T1 and T2. Okay, so these slopes are utilized to then extract this time scale. Okay. So very quickly, if you're looking at the tungsten isotope evolution of the Earth, so this is time going from zero to maybe about 60 million years. This is bulk Earth, which would be similar to what the undifferentiated meteorites would look like, or the carbonaceous meteorites, or the ordinary chondrites. And then as you differentiate the planet, you basically have a tungsten-rich, hafnium-poor core, and in the silicate part, you have hafnium-rich, tungsten-poor. So the silicate mantle would evolve again to more radiogenic ratios, and the core would evolve to less radiogenic ratios. And so when you look at the actual observations, so this is a suite of carbonaceous chondrites, and this is the composition of bulk silicate Earth. So compared to bulk silicate Earth, the meteorites are negative, meaning what this is telling us is that core formation was happening before hafnium became extinct. So if I dial a slide back, if all of this core formation happened after hafnium became extinct, then you could have three different reservoirs with different hafnium tungsten ratios, but they would all have the same tungsten isotopic composition because you do not have any more of this hafnium 182 still present. So once you have gone past six half-lives, if you have additional core formation, that is not going to be associated with generation of any new tungsten 182 because there is no hafnium 182. So right off the bat, the fact that the silicate mantle is different from the chondritic mantle by 2 epsilon units is telling us that core formation was ongoing well before tungsten became extinct. And if you do simple models in terms of the growth of the planet, you would come up with a time scale that the mean time of core formation was 11 million years. And in this case, the mean time scale is corresponding to something like 2/3 of the core being formed, or about 2/3 of the Earth having been formed. Now, this simple calculation assumes that you have full equilibration between the metal and silicate as you're building the planet. If you assume that there is or if you assume that equilibration is incomplete, that the metal and the silicate do not have perfect equilibration, it increases this 11 million year timescales. And that has been accounted for in many, many different N-body simulations. So hafnium tungsten has almost become like the go-to chronometer that people use in N-body simulations to constrain growth rates of planetary embryos and planets. So this is sort of just pointing out in roughly 2002, we are characterizing the terrestrial samples by this one single value of about zero. But with the progress of time, what we start realizing is actually bulk silicate Earth is not characterized by a single value. And so on the x-axis here, and on the x-axis here is tungsten isotopic composition. Unfortunately, this one is in units of epsilon, and this one is in units of mu. But the take-home point from both is, this is the bulk composition of the Earth at zero. If you look at modern basalts, this is a study by Wilbold et al. In 2011 and Tubul et al. In 2012. Modern basalts in both cases appear to fall close to zero. And up here, you're seeing the Ishua metasediments that deviate away from zero. And importantly, they deviate to the positive side. And Tubul et al. Likewise found komatiites that are about 2.8 billion years old that also plot about 20 mu units away from this composition. So 0.2 and 20 in this case are basically the same scale. Excuse me. Interestingly enough, 3.5 billion year komatiite does not have a measured anomaly. So there are things in this set of observations that I think are not fully explained. One is you would notice that the magnitude of the anomaly, so these are basically 3.7 billion year old metasediments, but the magnitude of this anomaly between 3.7 and 2.8 is about the same. They're both about, you know, 20 mu units. And even at 3.5, there are domains in the mantle that actually are zero. So what this is telling us is that we probably haven't fully characterized the scale of heterogeneity in these tungsten isotopes. And we still don't have a good answer as to why this is not attenuating as a function of time, because this system basically becomes extinct after 60 million years. So kind of keep this 20 mu units in mind, because I'll come back to it again.
I guess I can sit
at this right there.
Will it be possible that the reservoir where this anomaly is coming is non-mixing? Would that be a possibility of a way to preserve this anomaly?
So that's absolutely possible, that they're not mixing away with the rest of the mantle. And so maybe what you're seeing is a mantle domain that had been mixed away up here at zero. And then this is coming from a domain that has you know, accretional heterogeneities left over. Because again, you cannot make these heterogeneities after 60 million years of the start of the solar system. And the moon forming giant impact, depending upon whom you talk to, is somewhere between 50 and maybe 70 million years. And so this is basically a time scale that is prior to the formation of the moon. So that's how old these anomalies have to be.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think somebody in a previous talk mentioned that there were negative tungsten isotope anomalies too. Could you talk about those?
I certainly can, and I certainly will.
Oh. So, okay.
So just hold on to that. So that's actually a great point, and I'm going to make that again here. So the other thing that we don't quite understand about that figure, or about this figure, is notice that there are no negative tungsten anomalies up here. So all of these anomalies are positive, and there's no difference between 3.8 and 2.8, and they're domains that are older than 2.8 and are basically still at zero. Okay, so but the idea at this point still was that these ancient heterogeneities are still getting attenuated by the time modern day rolls around. And then what we did find are additional heterogeneities associated with samarium and neodymium. So again, we're going to look at this system, 146 samarium decaying to 142. And this system is great for looking at crust mantle differentiation, as I talked about, because they're both lithophile. And when you melt the mantle, they're both incompatible, which means that they preferentially go into the melt. But neodymium is a little more incompatible. So the daughter product is going to preferentially go into the melt compared to the parent. Okay. So this is a study that came out in 2003. And so what you're looking at, again, are these Ischua metasediments. And so this is neodymium 142 on the x-axis. These are a set of standards. So again, bulk silicate earth is at about zero. And these metasediments, which are basically crustal products, are shifted to the right-hand side. So this, by the way, has got nothing to do with this non-chondritic versus chondritic earth model. This is basically tracking differentiation in the Hadean world on the earth. Okay, so as I said, neodymium 142 prefers the melt over samarium. So basically the melt should actually have an enrichment of this decay product. So the, in theory, what you would expect is the melt to actually plot on the left-hand side compared to the bulk composition. So the fact that the melt compositions or the crustal compositions are actually shifted to the right indicates that the reservoir that was making these material was actually not down here. The reservoir that was making these guys were actually even further out here. So that is telling us that by 3.8, you had depleted the mantle in incompatible elements, so much that the crustal products coming out of the mantle was shifted to the right of bulk silicate earth composition. So this is actually quite a profound observation, because it's telling us that you didn't have little dregs of crust that had built up by 3.8. You had actually built up a fairly big volume of crust. We don't see that today. Roberta has a question, comment.
Isn't there always a problem, though, that you can say they came from a depleted mantle, but you can't say what volume that depleted mantle was, and that's going to tell you how much crust there would have been. There could have been a little bit of crust, you know, in light rare earth enriched crust that's the complement to this mantle.
So that's certainly possible. I guess you could actually model this in terms of you could basically model it to see how much mantle you actually have to deplete to generate these magnitudes of the anomalies, right? Because if you have to generate, let's say, these anomalies by depleting only a tiny volume of mantle, then you would have to drive big fractionations in samarium and neodymium, whereas if you generate these anomalies from a larger volume of the mantle, the magnitude of the samarium and neodymium fractionations, you don't have to make it as big. So I guess you can kind of model that to then see what volume of the mantle you would have to deplete. But yes, I agree, there's going to be a trade-off. Yeah. But in any case, this is still a really powerful observation because, again, it's telling us that the mantle had been depleted to generate these compositions. And another interesting point, though, is that at this point of time, we did not see any complementary reservoir. So remember, if these guys are coming out of a reservoir that shifted to the left, and bulk Earth has to be on zero, because that's where bulk Earth is today, there has to be a complementary reservoir somewhere on the left-hand side to balance the neodymium and samarium mass isotopes. And at this point, we still hadn't observed this negative 142 neodymium. Okay. And it turned out about a decade later, those negative 142 anomalies were discovered. So this is a paper by Rizzo et al. So again, what you're seeing is these Ischua sediments with these positive values, but also negative 142 anomalies showing up. And this is reflecting the enriched crustal products that directly came out of something that would be that would have a bulk composition of about zero. And then the modern day mantle appears very, very close to zero again, meaning that these anomalies appear to have dissipated by about 2.5 or so. So unlike the tungsten, it does appear that with time, these neodymium anomalies become smaller. And by modern day, it appears that it's almost all gone, except there's a recent paper in March that showed some small anomalies in neodymium from the reunion plume. Zach.
I don't want to be uncharitable, but if you didn't have any of the purple shading on this plot, you would have a very, very hard time saying there been any, there were any of those, you know, the red lines that show a decay in the heterogeneity. Right? It seems like there's this one thing happening in these greenlands, that's the Ischua samples. And then other than that, it's basically stable.
These guys and these guys.
Well, the second guys are basically the same scatter as the guys at the end.
That's right, yeah. So you're seeing this positive and you're seeing this negative.
Sure, but I'm saying, sorry, the ones in the black rectangle have essentially the same scattering range as the much more modern samples.
These?
Just about, yeah. Seems pretty similar to me. But, I mean, within the uncertainties, which I don't really know how to interpret.
No, so these, I think, are certainly resolved.
Sure, those ones.
These are certainly resolved. Clear. These ones are also certainly resolved from zero. None of these are really resolved from zero. Again, with the one possible exception being this very recent work on the reunion plume.
So looking at the opposite, though, of not looking at the anomalies, but I noticed that like Nuwabatuk and Akasa are just perfectly on the line. So that means they were sampling mantle that was
that hadn't been depleted. Yeah. That's right. So at this point, I would argue there are a few things that we don't quite know.
You mentioned several times that samarium and neodymium is lithophile element.
That's right.
But that's based on one atmosphere, a low pressure experiment, right? So what if it's a high pressure? Is there any experiment that or calculation show is still lithophile?
I think they're still going to be lithophile. I am not going to say that you cannot put a part per trillion or part per quadrillion samarium and neodymium into the core. but for certainly they're still going to be lithophile even at high pressures. They're not going to become siderophile.
Just make an analogy between a hafnium and tungsten, because that's two those two elements is just two. It's very close. Just like a neodymium and a samarium, and they behave differently. I just wonder if we increase pressure, or if it behaves differently, one become like lithophile and one become less lithophile. And will that change the story here? Because we do have some elements that change from lithophile to siderophile at high pressure.
Which
ones? Say magnesium. Not go through totally like from lithophile to sclerophile, but at high pressure, at high temperature, it does change to, it does can go through the liquid core. The same MgO precipitation. Usually elements become more sclerophile when it goes to high temperature or high pressure.
Sure. I think for samarium and neodymium, I'm not sure how much of an effect that would be. In part because we're looking at these fractionations between melt and residue happening at fairly low pressures. We're not talking about lower mantle pressures, right? These fractionations are in the upper part of the mantle. So they're low pressure effects, Dominique.
I'm just trying to help you. I think it also has to do with the fact that you're dealing with a major element, and when you increase your pressure, you're going to change your mineral phases, and that's why you're going to change the behavior of magnesium versus iron, for instance. It's not going to make any difference on the rare earth, or it should not.
It should not, but yeah.
When we're talking about elements like this, I mean, you went back to a different scale than your RNS processes here.
That's right.
Yeah. May I make a comment on the lithophile to chalcophile element transition? I think many years ago, Bernie Wood showed that niobium might be that case.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a lot of controversy on that study.
Okay. So from my perspective, one of the takeaways from this is, Dan, sorry.
It's probably a silly question. Do you worry at all about the possible alterations or something for those old rocks? Like, I'm assuming that those rocks were erupted 3.5 billion years ago, and you basically assume that they wouldn't have any chemical exchange with the deep interior, which I believe it is correct, but they will have plenty of time to chemically interact with atmosphere and weathering and all that stuff.
Yeah. So one thing still to keep in mind about these isotopes is, one, you're not changing the isotope ratio anymore after about 600 million years. So you're locking in the isotope ratio. And second, weathering processes are going to fractionate things like samarium to neodymium, but they're not going to affect the neodymium isotopic ratios. Okay. So what I was going to say is, from my perspective, one of the points to make is there's this enormous period of time with very little observations. So we have some cursory observations of heterogeneities in the Hadean, maybe in the early Archean down here, and then most of the observations are basically here at time zero. And this enormous period of time has got very, very few observations. So in reality, we really don't know how rapidly these anomalies got attenuated away. Okay, so again, when we look at neodymium in the modern day mantle, there does not appear to be any anomaly. So this is a study by Jackson and Carlson. So again, you're looking at these older rocks that shows both positive and negative anomalies, and then these are all of the zero age samples. So these are ocean island basalts or plumes, and these are morbs, and most of them are, or all of them in this case, are basically zero. Okay, so about the same time as the Tubul and Wilbold study on the tungsten came out, we were noticing that we were seeing in the modern day mantle anomalies associated with extinct nuclides. And just to kind of make it simple, instead of looking at the real data points here, we are just going to look at the end member compositions of these ocean island basalts and plume basalts. And so we're looking at xenon that is produced by decay of iodine, which is a half-life of 16 million years. So the rule of thumb is after about 100 million years, the system is extinct. And so this is the helium xenon ratio against the xenon isotopic ratio. And again, if you have mixing between, let's say, a mid-ocean ridge basalt and the atmosphere where you're subducting air into the mantle, you would follow this line. And the plumes don't plot on that line, they plot in a different space. And likewise, if you want to generate this Mach composition by adding xenon 129 from iodine decay, you have to do that within the first 100 million years. You can't do it later on. So right off the bat, the fact that these two points lie where they lie tell you that the Morb source and the plume source had partially separated or partially differentiated within 100 million years. And then subsequent to that time period, you haven't erased these anomalies away, meaning that they're still present in the modern day mantle. So we don't quite know how big these anomalies were 4.5 billion years ago, or what the difference between these were 4.5 billion years ago, because they might have been attenuated by mixing of these two as well as by subduction of air. But I think we can categorically say that these accretional heterogeneities that were built up as the planet was being formed are still around in the modern day mantle. And that means that these are telling us about these very early episodes of Earth's formation. And then a few years later, tungsten observations came out that showed actually even in the tungsten isotopes, we are seeing anomalies in the modern day mantle. And so these are two papers, one by Rizzo et al. And one by Mundell, both sort of done at Maryland in Rich Walker's lab. So these are mantle plumes. And again, in this case, you're noticing a deviation that's on the order of 20 to 40 parts per million from this bulk silicate earth composition. So again, that's kind of interesting because this is sort of the magnitude of the anomaly that we saw 3.8 billion years ago. And that same magnitude of anomaly is being observed even in the modern day mantle. And then a more recent paper came out last year actually observed negative tungsten anomalies. And as I said, remember the way to interpret these negative tungsten anomalies would be basically to think about these as being in metal. You can generate negative tungsten anomalies associated with high pressure fractionation of hafnium and tungsten in a deep magma ocean. If somebody wants to really talk about that, I can talk about it. But in this study, the interpretation was that because these are negative, you are really looking at stranded iron metal that was left over in the mantle following core formation. And again, the amazing thing is that this is still available to be sampled in the modern day mantle. And again, remember, we were not seeing these negative values in any of, or so far we haven't seen these negative values in the older suite of rocks. So I'm basically going to wrap up here to say, where do we stand on the extinct nuclide anomalies? And what I'll say is that the extent of the heterogeneity that we established is not fully known. The extent of the heterogeneity in the modern day mantle, I would all argue, is also not yet fully established, because as I said, just a year ago, we noticed these negative tungsten anomaly. And this year, a couple months ago, there was the report of a potential neodymium anomaly in a modern day basalt from reunion. So I think this still has to play out in terms of what the magnitudes of these anomalies are in the modern day world, as well as what these anomalies are in the ancient world or in the Hadean. And once we establish that, we can talk about characteristic timescales over which these anomalies get attenuated, because I think that will provide us with some fundamental constraints on things like mixing timescales in the Hadean, which are not accessible by these longer-lived chronometers, because these longer-lived chronometers are not very sensitive to the first few hundred million years of Earth's history, whereas these extinct radionuclides are really powerful tools to look at the first few hundred million years of Earth's history, especially because there is no rock record from that time period. And so my third aspect of the talk was going to be about atmosphere, but this CIDR is really about heterogeneities in the mantle, so I think we can skip the atmosphere.
For the negative anomaly, for the negative tungsten anomaly, you just mentioned that people use strained iron reservoir to explain it. How do they distinguish the strained iron and outer core?
material?
So the idea is that if it was the outer core, the outer core would also be enriched in highly siderophile elements. They would have very high concentrations of things like iridium and platinum and rhenium, and we do not see these high concentrations in these sampled basalts.
But if it's strong iron, it could also be enriched in highly siderophile, right?
So not really. So if it's stranded iron, they don't have to be enriched in these elements, because those elements might already have been segregated in the core. And remember, the rhenium and ruthenium and all of these highly siderophile elements were resupplied to the mantle via the late veneer. So there was a period of time when the mantle was very depleted in these highly siderophile elements.
But I mean, if those strain iron was the relevant of the core formation,
mm-hmm.
It was once equilibrium with the magma ocean, and it should be enriched with those highly siderophile elements as well.
It could, but it doesn't have to be. So it would only be very rich in these highly siderophile elements if the magma ocean still has a sufficiently big inventory of highly siderophile elements. So remember, if you're looking at the very last stages of core formation, most of the highly siderophile elements have already been drawn out from the magma ocean, because these elements have such high compatibilities for the metal that the moment you segregate or the moment you precipitate the first metal out, most of the budget of these highly siderophile elements would go into those metals. And so then the metal that segregates out later is not going to have a high concentrations, because the magma ocean itself is depleted.
Okay, thank you.
So I think we're on coffee break. Thanks again.
Thank you.